Hi, Dave Emery here. This is side one of For the Record program number 820, interview with Ed Haslam about Ebola and the second edition of Dr. Mary's Monkey. This is being recorded on November 16th of the year 2014. And once again, it is my pleasure and my great privilege to bring back to our airwaves Ed Haslam, the author of a book which has really gone through three transmogrifications. First, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus that we talked about in the 1990s. Then a new edition, Dr. Mary's Monkey. And now, as of this year, a second and improved edition of Dr. Mary's Monkey. And here is Ed Haslam. Ed, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Dave. Good to be here.
Well, it is good to have you back indeed. Before we get into some of the new information about Dr. Mary's Monkey, in some of our previous discussions, you mentioned one of your first introductions to strange viruses carried by monkeys was when you saw a guy, I believe you have referred to him as the pirate, a guy who had a pet monkey, and you inquired of your father, who was a doctor, about whether you could get a pet monkey, and he said nope, because they carry strange viruses that we don't know much about. And you mentioned in a previous interview that one of the viruses he alluded to was something called Ebola Valley Fever. Ebola is a name that is very much on people's minds these days. I wonder if you would develop Ebola Valley Fever and sort of give us your thoughts about that disease and any you might have. If there's something you'd like to comment about with regard to the current outbreak and the absolute wild-eyed hysteria that has been preoccupying the mainstream media, please develop that for us.
Well, Dave, when we first talked, and it was almost 18 years ago, I mean, talked on the air, and the name of my book at the time was Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. The whole idea of monkey viruses was way out on a limb all by itself. I mean, nobody had any sense of familiarity with it. Nobody understood why anybody would be interested in it. It was a really exotic and almost obscure subject that alienated a lot of people from the get-go. And if you haven't heard about Ebola in the last 3 months, you've got your head in the sand, because, I mean, it's got about a, 90-plus percent awareness amongst everybody, because it's just on the news nonstop all the time now. And so we've had a real shift in the media landscape on this subject. And I find that shift interesting because there were a couple of other events that that occurred. One was the book Hot Zone by Richard Preston, which I'll talk more about in a little bit. And the other was that movie Outbreak that had Dustin Hoffman in it, which is essentially about hemorrhagic fever. And the point is, this is a emerging subject. And what you were referencing about the first chapter of my book called The Pirate, when I asked my father for a pet monkey and he told me no, that was in the early 60s when that conversation occurred. A couple of years later, in the mid-60s, I asked him if he would tell me a little bit more about these monkey viruses from Africa, because what I was noticing is that we had real serious professionals at a medical school that had a department on tropical medicine, tropical diseases, and these guys were really, really, really concerned about this, and I didn't see anything about it in the media. So I'm wondering, this is a disconnect, so I asked my father to tell me about it, and he said, well, the worst one we know about is called Ebola Valley Fever. And the importance of this is this conversation was in the mid-60s, right? And if you go to the mainstream media today and you look up Ebola, they tell you Ebola was discovered in 1976, like 12 years later, okay? So I've got a problem with that timeline. And one of the things we get into as we talk about PSYOPs and all this stuff is if you control the timeline, you control people's understanding of the development of events.
Sure. It's what Orwell wrote about in 1984. He who controls the past controls the present. He who controls the present controls the future. Go ahead, Ed.
And so my father died in 1972, so I'm quite sure, since he told me about Ebola, that the medical community knew about Ebola quite a while before 1976. So I started looking into it, and what I realized was that what happened in 1976, what they're calling the discovery, is some guy up at CDC photographed the virus with an electron microscope. I mean, that's not that's no more discovering it than Al Gore discovered the internet, okay? I mean, it has a long history. It's a very obscure disease, fortunately, but its roots are back in the mid-1960s. And my father was a professor at Tulane University. You see the name Tulane in the news frequently with Ebola, because they've been over there for a number of years preparing kind of breakout kits, things to hand out to doctors and nurses dealing with Ebola in the event that they should have a bigger eruption. They've had some little flurries in the past. And, you know, Ebola, the game just couldn't get more serious. And the problem is we're left to dealing with the same news sources that we all know and love, trying to sort out what is really going on here. And the problem is the game's not over yet, you know. I mean, when this thing started, the outbreak of 2014 started in the summer, I kept a pretty good eye on the numbers, and what I noticed is they got to 10,000 cases and 5,000 dead by Halloween. Now, that gives you a doubling time of about 30 days from the outset of this outbreak. Well, a doubling time of 30 days basically consumes the population of the planet in about 3 years, okay? And I hope the doubling time does not continue, okay? But the seriousness of this whole thing is very real. Another thing that comes out is, you go back to this Hot Zone book, written by Richard Preston. Well, Richard Preston comes out of MIT. He was trained as a scientific writer and given all kind of cushy entree positions in New York Magazine and all that stuff. And when he writes Hot Zone, it's immediately a bestseller. Everybody loves it and everything else. And now there's a book out written by the scientist that he was basically writing about who says, hey, wait a second. He got all kind of stuff wrong. I mean, Ebola does not turn your organs into jello. You know, it does other stuff. It makes you bleed, but it's not even currently considered to be a hemorrhagic fever. I mean, so there's a lot of evolving stuff that we've been thrown in the popular media, particularly the movie Outbreak, which talks about the idea of a mutation of Ebola. At any rate, so I'm not an expert in Ebola, and I want to sort of stop here on it, but let me just summarize with the point that Ebola is way older than 1976, and the medical community has known about it for quite a while, and I don't, as usual, trust what we're being told in the media, and I don't know the sinister roots of all this stuff, but I will say this, you know, in terms of countries that have responded to the Ebola outbreak with actually getting doctors there and getting people on the ground and everything else, Cuba has done probably the best job of anybody until this week when China showed up with 1,000 people. But, you know, the Cuban response was early, it was appropriate, it was thorough. And I don't think it gets the coverage in the American media that it deserves because of the normal bias they have against all things Cuban.
Yeah, very quickly, just backtracking a little bit. And again, for the benefit of our listeners, we have done interviews going back to 1996, some of them several hours in length. In some ways, Ed, I almost feel but kind of a male midwife or godfather to parts of your investigation, because as you have plumbed the investigative depths, so to speak, pieces of information such as your discovery of where the reactor that Mary Sherman was using, you came across that, and we talked about that on the show, and some of the other information you've developed a guy who worked for for Douglas MacArthur. We've broken on the program. When you hear, just for the listeners' benefit, because all kinds of listeners have been contacting me and asking me, do I have any information about Ebola as a biological warfare weapon? The answer is, specifically no, nor can I say whether there was any proactive element in the outbreak there. I also don't know that there wasn't. However, when you hear Ed talk about his father being a professor at Tulane University and knowing about Ebola as a monkey virus in the early and mid-60s, this is against the background of things we have spoken about and that Ed has written about in our past interviews and his books about Tulane being central to research into tropical diseases, the strategic and economic importance of the city of New Orleans, its relationship to Latin America, its relationship to research into tropical diseases and research into primates, and also to something which is a direct transitional element and pivot point to the current discussion, Dr. Alton Ochsner. We can talk about him. We will undoubtedly talk about him as well. Ed, your new book, for listeners' benefit, what I'm going to do, in addition to referring people to the book, I'm going to put in the article length description for this program key points of information from a previous interview explaining who Judith Very Baker was, her relationship with Lee Oswald, with Alton Ochsner, and with cancer research, and some of the specifics so that people who are flying blind hearing this interview for the first time can get themselves located briefly and then hopefully, ideally, order the book. There is way too much new information for us to successfully recap the information from previous editions, so I will include a nice chunk of that in the written description. In your new edition, Ed, you have a number of fascinating points, and before we actually get into who Mary Sherman was, and I'm going to leave it to you to explain that, you mentioned that you wrote that J. Edgar Hoover ordered that there be no FBI participation in any investigation into Mary Sherman's murder. Develop that further for us, if you would.
Okay, well, first of all, Mary Sherman was found in her apartment naked, stabbed 7 or 8 times, and set on fire. And that was a fairly sensational line of events. But the New Orleans Police Department, when they started looking into it, they found a name in her address book that alarmed them so much that they immediately contacted the FBI and said, tell the boss, we've got this guy's name in Mary Sherman's address book, and we need your help investigating this thing. And Hoover immediately said, no, this is a local murder. We don't have any jurisdiction. Do not investigate this on pain of reprimand. Okay? This is what he's telling all of his agents, all right, through the special agents in charge. And the interesting point is his rationale here is, since her body was found in her apartment, it's a local murder, and they're a federal agency. Well, the whole thing that really happened to Mary Sherman was she was electrocuted and her right arm was burned off, and all that occurred at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in New Orleans, which is federal property, and the FBI did have jurisdiction. So this whole concept that I develop in the book, and I think it's very reasonable and very well argued, is that her arm got burned off on federal property. They terminated her because her heart was still beating, put her in a body bag, took her back to her apartment, and faked a murder scene, okay? And the New Orleans Police Department asked the FBI to help them, and the FBI said no, okay? Now, on page 2 of that memo from J. Edgar Hoover telling his agents, don't do this, right? There's a note that says, Mary Sherman, surgeon, blah, 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 right arm, rib cage burned off. Next sentence, somebody's name was found in her address book. And that somebody's name is redacted, but we can see by the length of the redaction that it's only one word. There's no first name involved. And that word is 6 letters long. Well, Haslam is 6 letters long, but so is Oswald, O-S-W-A-L-D. And if you don't know at this point in time, Mary Sherman knew Lee Oswald. And we know this from several witnesses, including Judith Very Baker, who you mentioned. And Judith Very Baker tells us that Mary Sherman telephoned Lee Oswald. Well, Well, if she telephoned him, the idea that his name might be in her address book is pretty good. So I contact the FBI, and I said, hey, guys, we got Freedom of Information, we got JFK Records Act, it's a 50-year-old memo, and all I want is one word. And the FBI tells me, nope, we're not telling you. Appeal to the Department of Justice. So I appeal to all forms, appeal to the Department of Justice. They tell me, we don't have to tell you, morally, et cetera, and we're not going to tell you.
What was so interesting about this, excuse me for butting in, Ed, but it reminds me of one of those old Bugs Bunny cartoons, you know, where Bugs Bunny is in a haunted house, and he knocks on the door and he says, yeah, anybody in there? And the voice says, no, there's nobody in here. And you know, then Bugs Bunny does the double take. You know, and obviously, whatever it was, whatever that name was, Oswald would certainly be a good, let's see, F-E-R-R-I-E would also be another one, six letters. Whatever it is obviously extremely important, and more than a half century after Mary Sherman's murder, which took place in the summer of 1964, there is something about that contact of hers that is still extremely sensitive.
Yes, and if it is Oswald, then we know that Hoover knew Mary Sherman was connected to Oswald, and he told his agents not to investigate the murder of somebody connected to Oswald on the absolute day that the Warren Commission arrived in New Orleans to investigate that leg of the investigation. So, you know, when they tell us we got all these, you know, record acts and new openness and everything else, and I'm saying, okay, so why won't you tell me one word? You know, I mean, it's not really up to me to guess what this word is. It's up to the government to tell the people what the word is.
Exactly. It begs the question as to what is open and what is going to be going through the opening. We'll leave that to people's imagination. Judith Ferry Baker was discussed at considerable length in our previous interview, Ed, for the record, 644, done in the late summer of 2008. And again, the description for that program will be in the description for this one, so that even on a cursory basis, people can flesh out their understanding of Judith Ferry Baker, her relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald, and some of the events, institutions, and people that we are going to be discussing. She signed Lee Harvey Oswald's time cards from, I believe it was, Riley Coffee, and yet you write that the Warren Commission omitted those from their exhibits. Develop that for us, Ed.
All right. Well, first of all, Judith Ferry Baker and Lee Harvey Oswald both started working at the Riley Coffee Company in New Orleans on May 10th. They both started on the same day. They both started in a subsidiary of Riley called Standard Coffee Company, okay? And Judith was the secretary to the head of Standard Coffee Company, who was an ex-FBI agent who was involved with Alt Noshner in his political action organization called INCA. And she and Lee were there as a cover job so that Lee could run around with Bannister and do all his spy work, and she and Lee could sneak out and go over to David Ferry's apartment to work on the biological weapon. And so she had the ability, I mean, when Lee was not there to clock himself out, I mean, his time cards were being approved by Bill Moynihan, who was Judy's boss. And given all of, and when Moynihan was not around, Judy herself would approve the time cards. So you see Moynihan's initial and you see Judy's initial on Lee Harvey Oswald's time cards. Well, we can say that today because we have those time cards now. But given all of the stuff that was put in the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission report, including the dental records of Jack Ruby's mother that has absolutely nothing to do with anything in the case, the time cards of the guy who's being accused of murdering the president are omitted from the Warren Commission volumes. And what's interesting is we know from the paper trail now that they were collected by a FBI agent by the name of Warren DeBries from the Riley Coffee Company. They were turned over to the FBI. They were given to the Warren Commission, and the Warren Commission gave them back, and they got put in an FBI file and never published. Why? What is it they did not want to know? Well, the first thing a competent investigator will say is whose initials are that. Let's get that person in here and talk to her. Well, the initial, that J, belonged to Judith Ferry Baker. And that's what they did not want. They did not want her to be found, because finding her exposes the entire biological weapon project, which involves murder and stuff like that in Louisiana in the summer of 63.
And part, by the way, William Riley, who owned the company for which both Lee Harvey Oswald and Judith Vary Baker worked, was deeply involved with the anti-Castro Cuban support effort and many of the political elements that figure in a prominent way in your massive investigation. So you have a lot of other information that further develops the relationship between Lee Harvey Oswald, Judith Vary Baker, Arnold Oxner, Cancer Research, Operation Mongoose, etc. And again, if this seems incomprehensible to listeners, get the book, and maybe prior to that, check out the description for this program and other broadcasts, and it will flesh out your understanding. In your new edition, Ed, you write of Victoria and Owen Hawes, H-A-W-E-S, and some of the information they provided that gives further detail to your investigation. Develop that for us, if you would.
Victoria and Owen were a young married couple in their early 20s, and they lived in the patio apartments where Mary Sherman lived. And this is a small apartment complex. There's only about 13 apartments in it. And so everybody kind of knows everybody, and it's built around a courtyard where everybody can kind of keep an eye on everybody else. And so this was a fairly small community. And Victoria had two babies at home. And Owen was gone to work. And so because Victoria was there all day when packages needed to be delivered and stuff like that, she frequently accepted packages for neighbors, and some of these things were flowers, and some of these things were other things. And so Victoria was there all day. And one of the things about Victoria, she was from New Orleans, and she had gone to middle school with Lee Oswald. And so she knew Lee Oswald from middle school. And so when one day she's out there playing with her kids in the little tub on the patio and stuff, and she looks up through the sliding glass door, and there's Lee Oswald, who she recognizes. And, you know, she basically says, "Hi, Lee, you know, what are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, I'm looking for Juan Valdez." And she said, "Well, Juan actually lives in the next apartment," and she sends Lee on his way and stuff. And then she sees Lee coming and going out of Juan Valdez's apartment on a fairly regular basis. And her and her husband notice something really unusual, is that when Lee goes in there, particularly in the evenings, the way the apartments are set up, the headboard to their bed is up against a wall, which is the wall to Juan Valdez's bathroom. So every time he flushes the toilet, they hear the water running through the pipes in the wall. Well, when Lee goes over there, they start flushing the toilet 25, 30 times in a row, like they're disposing of a large quantity of something.
Something that could be disposed of through the commode, too, which a lot of things couldn't.
Right. And where that would be the convenient way of doing it, okay? And so I learn about these people and actually almost accidentally get in contact with them, but I start asking them the logical questions. And I said, "Well, you know, how many times did this happen? Like once or twice?" And they said, no, this was like an every night occurrence for about a month. Okay, and the month we're talking about here is, you know, late July and into August of 1963. Well, this is, when you read Judith Vary Baker's book, you realize this is when they're starting to kill 100, 200, 300 mice a day. And they're doing this over David Ferry's apartment. They're doing this as part of this biological weapon thing. They're killing the mice. They're cutting out the tumors. They're grinding everything up in a blender. Judith is making the test tubes and the slides, and she puts everything in a lunchbox. She takes it over to Mary Sherman's apartment. She's got a key. She lets herself into Mary Sherman's apartment, deposits all that stuff. And for Mary to look at, under her oil immersion microscope, which is like a really super expensive high-tech microscope where you can see things with unusual clarity. And so Mary is overseeing this project. Judith is bringing this stuff over there. And the question is, when Mary is finished with all that stuff, particularly the stuff she doesn't need, who disposes of it? Well, that's what they've got Lee Oswald coming and picking the stuff up, bringing it into Juan Valdez's apartment, and they're disposing of the raw material from the biological weapon project. I mean, that's my take on it, and that is part of what is presented in this. And then Owen turns around and starts talking to me. We get in this conversation about this New Orleans police detective who calls me at home one day, and he's telling me about Juan Valdez. And he said, you know, I wanted to arrest Juan Valdez. They wouldn't let me. And so we're talking about Juan Valdez, and Owen says, Owen winds up telling me about this police report he's got from the burglary of Mary Sherman's apartment, not the night she's murdered, but about 9 months beforehand. And we finally pinned down the date of this, and it's August 31st, 1963. Now, this is the day that, I mean, what happens on August 28th, Martin Luther King gives his I Have a Dream speech. On August 29th, the Congress on Racial Equality decides to do a black voter registration drive in Clinton, Louisiana, which happens to be the day that Clay Shaw drives David Ferry and Lee Oswald and the biological weapon up from New Orleans to bring it to the mental hospital at Jackson, okay? And they get seen there, right? And then 2 days later, Lee drives Judy up there by himself. This is a long way. I mean, this is 4 hours up, 4 hours back, right? It's a total day's commitment to do anything. And by the time he gets back, I mean, what happens that day is Mary Sherman leaves and goes to London, and her apartment is vacant, and somebody breaks into her apartment. This is all in the police report, okay? About 11 o'clock at night, and they remove what is, in today's dollars, $12,500 worth of miscellaneous. Now, miscellaneous is not money. It is not jewelry. It is not furs. It's the other stuff.
Ed, we are almost out of time on this side. I'd like to briefly jump in, obviously, to a new listener. Many of the links between some of the things we have spoken about will be necessarily partially opaque. I want to make two suggestions. First and foremost, that listeners go out and get the book. And by the way, I get no money whatsoever from this, nor does this or any of the other stations that carry the program. Ed, we are coming up on gift-giving season, so people who would perhaps like to leave a very important, very fascinating, although perhaps unholiday-like, disturbing piece of information, where can they get your book and flesh out their understanding?
Well, the new book, which is a hardcover, is the 50th anniversary of Mary Sherman's death, and we have 25 new pages in there. It's got crime scene photos and all that stuff. It's in the catalog, so you can order it from any bookstore in America if you want to go to your local bookstore. You can also, of course, get it on Amazon, and if you want a signed copy, signed by me, you can go to my website, which is drmarysmonkey.com, but spell out doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, Mary's, no apostrophe, monkey.com, and you can, using PayPal, just order a copy, and I'll sign it and send it to you.
Right, and again, in the description for this show, a nice chunk of it will be the description for the record, 644, about the first edition of Dr. Mary's Monkey. There also is a three-hour, done in six half-hour segments, interview that Ed and I did back in 1996 about Dr. Feb, called Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, which will sort of give them a good understanding of the foundation upon which Ed's research has been done since. We're going to talk more about this in Side 2. However, this concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 820, interview with Ed Haslam about Ebola and the second edition of Dr. Mary's Monkey. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.